Good morning. Yes, it is a good morning. It's not raining yet, right? As I drove in, I thought, well, it might rain while I was coming in, but it didn't rain. But I think we are supposed to have some rain. And you just listened to the weather forecast, so you know better than I do. I wasn't listening to the weather forecast. Well, we're coming up to the 4th of July, and as you heard Scott's show, he had a lot of questions about that sort of thing. I'm going to do a piece that we did. I read Frederick Douglass's What to a Slave is the 4th of July speech, which is arguably one of the greatest speeches that's ever been given in the United States. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with that, but it is a phenomenal speech. And it's all about how Frederick Douglass, who obviously was an African-American gentleman, how he looked at celebrating the 4th of July since he was a slave. Slaves didn't celebrate the 4th of July. It just wasn't, you know, it, what it was to slaves is it was a the beginning of a country that was going to enslave them. But the speech is very moving, very interesting. I'm going to play that for you, but I'm not going to do it myself. I did it myself about 2 years ago on the air for you, but I found a copyrighted free rendition of it, a person that does it and does it well, as opposed to the way I did it. And we're going to go into that. We're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about family. We're going to talk about my missed opportunity yesterday. When I left here yesterday, I was all excited because I was pretty sure I was going to have a puppy dog to take the place of my old Cheyenne, who passed away about 4 months ago. And when we started out looking, we found this litter of five or six, and they were just adorable, and they reminded me of Cheyenne. We were going to drive over. Excuse me, my phone just talked to me. That always throws me off. and then makes me cough. We were going to drive over. We did drive. We started to drive over to Dayton, outside of Dayton, where this I'm not sure what they call it, shelter, I guess, dog shelter is. And we were going to drive over, and we were supposed to do an interview on the way over by phone. And we looked at the website, and there were still three of the six left. And we knew they'd go fast, but this particular shelter wouldn't hold any of them for us because you had to do your interview before they even knew that they were going to let you have it. So on our way, we got about halfway there, got a phone call, which was at 2:30 when we were supposed to have our phone interview, which I was expecting it. And we got picked up the phone, and the lady said, "I'm sorry, but the last of the six puppies is gone." So we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, puppy mills and shelters and that sort of thing. And you're welcome to call in. The phone number here is 740-383-9944. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about cats in the cradle. Family. The 4th of July is quite often a family time. And I was listening to the song Cats in the Cradle this morning. Stevens, what's his name? Well, anyway, you know who I'm talking about. And he was singing it, and it always grabs at my heart. I have two sons, and it's about a father and his son. Not that I don't love my daughter, Amy, but it always grabs at my heart because there are so many things that my sons and I can relate to in that song. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. I'm also going to, speaking of my daughter, I'm going to talk about my daughter and her first profession. She was a college soccer coach for women's soccer, and then also assistant for the men. So she's had her experience there, and a lot of people are going through right now. They're going through being recruited. Most of them, the really good ones have already been recruited for the fall. There are some that are being recruited right now for the spring sports, and at the college level. And that was my vocation for 18 years. And my daughter was a coach. She was she was a collegiate athlete, and she now has a son, my grandson, Huel Lamar. We call him HL. It's a family name, so don't hold it against the boy. HL has been recruited as a sophomore in high school to play on North Carolina. Not a branch, the North Carolina University on their baseball team. He's a 6'5" left-handed pitcher, which is, pretty unusual. And so he was heavily recruited by, Duke and North Carolina State and North Carolina and, some other schools. Nobody out here, but this is pretty far away to be recruited for baseball. And he is, I guess, rated in the top 25 in the nation as far as pitchers go, available pitchers, high school pitchers. Now, his team just happened to win the North Carolina State Baseball Tournament last week. It was kind of fun to hear that, and so he's a champion. And we were going to have both he and his mother on today, but she's also a coach right now, a swimming coach, and she has a huge swim meet, so she couldn't do that because she's traveling across North Carolina right now to go to the swim meet, and HL swims as well, and he's going to be with her. Plus, he has some baseball games he has to get back to for tonight, so it just wasn't going to work out. So we'll talk about that, though, because I think lots of parents out there, whether you're being recruited by a Division I school or an NAIA school, it's kind of traumatic, and what do you do if you have a child or a grandchild that's being recruited? And maybe I can give you a few tips. I don't know. But those are the things we're going to talk about today. And I just lost my connection here with with the Google, which is going to play my Frederick Douglass thing. So if you'll hang with me here, I will get him back, I think. And I want you to listen to the language in this is a little stilted because of the time, you'll have to listen closely, I think, so you can understand what he's saying, but you won't have to. It's not that difficult. So, anyway, we're going to do that here momentarily as soon as I can find it again, and you will hear what to the slave is the 4th of July. Now, listen to Frederick Douglass, what he says about how little it means, not that it's a bad thing, but slaves didn't have any opportunities back in this day. So listen to how he talks about that. All right, this is What to a Slave is the 4th of July, as the orator was Frederick Douglass, who wrote this. And I'm trying to remember where he did it. I cannot remember that, of course. Okay, I'm going to have it on here momentarily.
See these plastic toasters?
Well, maybe I won't. Hang on just a second. We'll get that back in a moment. My problem was I forgot I had to skip the ads. Here we go.
The papers and placards Say that I am to deliver a 4th of July oration. This certainly sounds large and out of the common way for me. It is true that I have often had the privilege to speak in this beautiful hall and to address many who now honor me with their presence. But neither their familiar faces nor the perfect gauge I think I have of Corinthian Hall seems to free me from embarrassment. The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight. That I am here today is, to me, a matter of astonishment as well as of gratitude. You will not, therefore, be surprised if in what I have to say, I evince no elaborate preparation, nor grace my speech with any high-sounding exordium. With little experience and with less learning, I have been able to throw my thoughts hastily and imperfectly together. And trusting to your patient and generous indulgence, I will proceed to lay them before you. This, for the purpose of this celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to the day and to the act of your great deliverance, and to the signs and to the wonders associated with that act and that day. This celebration also marks the beginning of another year of your national life and reminds you that the Republic of America is now 76 years old. I am glad, fellow citizens, that your nation is so young. 76 years, though a good old age for a man, is but a mere speck in the life of a nation. 70 years and 10 is the allotted time for individual men, but nations number their years by thousands. According to this fact, you are, even now, only in the beginning of your national career, still lingering in the period of childhood. I repeat, I am glad this is so. There is hope in the thought, and hope is much needed under the dark clouds which lower above the horizon. The eye of the reformer is met with angry flashes, portending disastrous times. But his heart may well beat lighter at the thought that America is young and that she is still in the impressible stage of her existence. May he not hope that high lessons of wisdom, of justice, and of truth will yet give direction to her destiny. Were the nation older, the patriot's heart might be sadder, and the reformer's brow heavier. Its future might be shrouded in gloom, and the hope of its prophets go out in sorrow. There is consolation in the thought that America is young. Great streams are not easily turned from channels worn deep in the course of ages. They may sometimes rise in quiet and stately majesty, and inundate the land, refreshing and fertilizing the earth with their mysterious properties. They may also rise in wrath and fury and bear away on their angry waves the accumulated wealth of years of toil and hardship. They, however, gradually flow back to the same old channel and flow on as serenely as ever. But while the river may not be turned aside. It may dry up and leave nothing behind but the withered branch and the unsightly rock. To howl in the abyss-sweeping wind the sad tale of departed glory. As with rivers, so with nations. Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too. Great enough to give frame to a great age. It does not often happen to a nation to raise at one time such a number of truly great men. The point from which I am compelled to view them is not certainly the most favorable. And yet, I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes. And for the good they did, and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. They loved their country better than their own private interests. And though this is not the highest form of human excellence, all will concede that it is a rare virtue, and that when it is exhibited, it ought to command respect. He who will intelligently lay down his life for his country is a man whom it is not in human nature to despise. Your fathers staked their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on the cause of their country. In their admiration of liberty, they lost sight of all other interest. They were peace men, but they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage. They were quiet men, but they did not shrink from agitating against oppression. They showed forbearance, but they knew its limits. They believed in order, but not in the order of tyranny. With them, nothing was settled that was not right. With them, justice, liberty, and humanity were final, not slavery and oppression. You may well cherish the memory of such men. They were great in their day and generation. Their solid manhood stands out the more as we contrast it with these degenerate times. How circumspect, exact, and proportionate were all their movements. How unlike the politicians of an hour. Their statesmanship looked beyond the passing moment and stretched away in strength into the distant future. They seized upon eternal principles and set a glorious example in their defense. Mark them. Fully appreciating the hardships to be encountered, firmly believing in the right of their cause, honorably inviting the scrutiny of an onlooking world, reverently appealing to heaven to attest their sincerity, soundly comprehending the solemn responsibility they were about to assume, wisely measuring the terrible odds against them, your fathers, the fathers of this republic, did most deliberately, under the inspiration of a glorious patriotism and with a sublime faith in the great principles of justice and freedom, lay deep the cornerstone of the national superstructure, which has risen and still rises in grandeur around you. Of this fundamental work, this day is the anniversary. Our eyes are met with demonstrations of joyous enthusiasm. Banners and pennants wave exultingly on the breeze. The din of business, too, is hushed. Even Mammon seems to have quitted his grasp on this day. The ear-piercing fife and the stirring drum unite their accents with the ascending peal of 1,000 church bells. Prayers are made, hymns are sung, and sermons are preached in honor of this day. While the quick martial tramp of a great and multitudinous nation, echoed back by all the hills, valleys, and mountains of a vast continent, bespeak the occasion one of thrilling and universal interest, a nation's jubilee. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of national justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as in heart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence, bequeathed by your fathers, is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct. And let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the examples of a nation whose crimes, towering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrevocable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song. And they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous, yes, yesterday are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on the 4th of July. Whether returned to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command. And yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear someone of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws of their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? The manhood of the slave is conceded. It is admitted in the fact that Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalties, the teaching of the slave to read or to write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then I may consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your street, when the fowls of the air, when the cattle on your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, then will I argue with you that the slave is a man. For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. Is it not astonishing that while we are plowing, planting, and reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, artists, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God, and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty, that he is the rightful owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans, dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What? Am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes? To rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with the lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employment for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? That God did not establish it? That our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may. I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
Wow. That was Frederick Douglass. Well, that wasn't him. It was an actor doing his voice. But wow. And I know there are a lot of people out there saying, well, he was so rough on, you know. Well, he had a right to be pretty rough. I watched a show last night, and I'm trying to pull this up. I watched a show about where he was sent to be broken. Let's see if I can find this. Here it is, Mount Misery. And Mount Misery was a location, I think, on the Chesapeake Bay. It wasn't called Mount Misery. Anyway, it was owned, and I'm really struggling with who owned it. It was defense minister for Bush, and I can't remember his name. Anyway, it was a house where people would send, slave owners would send their slaves to be broken. You know, if they had an uppity slave, I guess that's the term they might use, they would send them to this place for a year, and this man would beat them. He would flog them. He would degrade them in every possible way till they were finally broken and would do as they were told to do. Well, that's where Frederick Douglass was sent as a slave. And it makes your heart ache. And for my friends who disagree, who believe that the African American in the United States is not worthy of a much higher esteem than what many have given him, I fear that they are very wrong in their opinion. Now, Frederick Douglass, if you listen to that speech closely, he had a better way of the American language than... And I understand, it was a little hard to understand. That language in those days was a little bit stilted. But he had a better way with the American with English than 99% of the people have right now in the United States. And, he was a brilliant man, even though he was not as educated early in life. Because he was a slave. He was not educated at all. As a matter of fact, there were laws against educating slaves. They didn't want slaves to become smart. They wanted slaves to do exactly what this gentleman at... I wish I could remember the name. It's the Hotel Misery or something like that. Anyway, when they sent them there, they wanted to drive all their intelligence and all their rebellion out of them. And obviously it worked. And I guess when he left there, he was a very broken man. But you can see within a few years, because he went there, I think, in his late teens, maybe early 20s. And the speech that he just gave, I think he was in his 40s, and I think it was given at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. I believe that's where it was given. And you can see it's hard to be upset with a man that's that angry the way his people were treated. He has every right. And I truly believe that all my African-American friends, all my Asian friends who live here in the United States, all my Hispanic friends who live here have every right in the world to have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder. And we need to find a way to help them smooth that chip down a little bit by being kinder, by being better, by being more thoughtful about where they come from. There's a big debate right now whether there's need for reparations for Native Americans. You want to talk about somebody that was treated poorly. Native Americans were treated almost as bad as slaves. As a matter of fact, some of them were put into slavery. The Trail of Tears, where hundreds of, or maybe even thousands of Native Americans were walked to death. And we don't think that we owe them something. I'm not sure we owe them thousands of dollars. There are a lot of people in this country right now that hate giving anybody else capital, any money for things that were done to their parents and their grandparents and great-great-grandparents. And I guess I understand that. And that's an argument that we can have at a much later date. But they deserve, first of all, everybody in the United States deserves respect if they act with kindness, if they act with empathy, if they act as if they care about each other. We have a lot of people that don't deserve that right now. I'm not sure where it's all going to go. But this is the 4th of July. So we need to be proud, I guess, that we are a nation that has gone in a better direction than so many nations. You can think of all the nations that are run by dictators and the like. People that kill for fun, and people that maim for fun, and people that force other people to do things that they wouldn't want to do themselves. At least in the United States, we have the opportunity to argue against that. Unfortunately, right now, it does seem like those without much money, their arguments are generally not listened to. And those with lots of money, their desires are listened to more than legitimate arguments from those without money. You know, when I'm saying their desires are listened to, what they want, whether it's money or power or whatever, is listened to more intently than a person who wants a bottle of milk for their baby and doesn't have any money. I guess that's kind of why on my show on Wednesdays, A Progressive Life, I talk a lot about that. I was brought up, I am an old white guy. And I'm embarrassed sometimes that I'm an old white guy because I see my fellow old white guys not giving a rat's behind about their fellow Americans. And like I said yesterday on the show, my wife and I have pretty much decided that we are citizens of the globe more so than citizens of the United States. Now, of course, we are citizens of the United States, and we are very lucky to be citizens of the United States. But we are citizens of the globe, all of us. What happens if we all are suffocated by our atmosphere, or frozen by our weather, or burned out by our fires, we're all going to take part of that. Now, I understand there are some that have lots of money that will have bomb shelters they can go down to and stay away from the fires and stuff like that. But what a miserable life we're leading ourselves into. Don't we all want to be happy with each other? I think we do. But there are people that want to be happy to themselves first, and if you get a little happiness, okay, but you better not get too much, because I didn't get any, right? I don't know. It drives me crazy to have so many people in the United States coveting so many people out, you know, around them. If you do read your Bible, and as most of my listeners know, I have read it more than once, but they also know that I am atheistic. If you read your Bible, to covet other people, what they have, is one of your major sins. And it seems odd to me that me as an atheist feel that more than a lot of my Christian brothers. Anyway, let's hope that we can all find a good reason to celebrate being in the United States on our anniversary, July 4th, which is, what is today, this first or second? I know. Anyway, this is the first, right? And so in 3 days, it'll be our birthday, and we can all celebrate that. Now, of course, if you were listening to Scott earlier, our birthday really came on the 2nd of July, not the 4th, or at least that's when we declared it, right? All right, well, we're going to be back with another 45 minutes after this 15-minute break for our news and our weather. I hope you join us back, and we'll be talking about a lot of different things, okay? All right, come on back.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio, The Talking Place,